Last November, I got together with my friends Todd and Carrie Alexander, and they put on an incredible event. The first annual Grenache Fest was held in Walla Walla, Washington on November 3rd, 2023. It featured 12 Grenache wines from Washington State producers. After the seminar, which was moderated by yours truly, there was a concert featuring Stephen Malkmus from the 90s underground grunge band Pavement, M. Ward, and Mark Pickerel, who is returning this year as our musical director. It was hands down one of the best wine events I've ever attended. And it was such a success that we're doing it again this year. Save the date, November 8th, 2024. If you're a producer wanting to pour your wines, if you want to volunteer, or if you simply want to attend this year's event, go to GrenacheFest.com and sign up on our email list to be the first to know regarding all things about this year's event. Hi, I'm Marvin John Tower, also known as MJ or the Black Wine Guy. I have worked in all facets of the wine business and have the distinction of being the world's first ever African-American fine and rare wine auctioneer. These days, I'm a journalist and podcaster, traveling the globe, having conversations with some of the most fascinating people in the world. In this show, I'm talking to the movers, shakers, and disruptors who inhabit the world of food, wine, music, and more. They'll share their experiences on how they made it, but more importantly, how they failed and got back up again. So grab a glass and let's get to it. This is Beats, Vines, and Life, where music, wine, and life collide.
Hey everybody, what's up? It's your boy MJ. Welcome to Beats, Vines, and Life. My guest today is the wine columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Letty Teague. Letty joined the Wall Street Journal in 2010. And in 2012, she won the James Beard Award food-related columns for her Wall Street Journal column. She was formerly the executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine from 1997 to 2009, where she oversaw the magazine's wine coverage and also wrote the monthly column Wine Matters. Letty has won three James Beard Awards, and in June 2015, she was inducted into the Wine Media Hall of Fame. Welcome, Letty.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, my God. So glad you're here. We have to intro the wine, and because, you know, let's tell the wine you brought, and we can talk about what happens with wine.
What happens with wine, the disappointment thereof. And I am doubly sorry because, as MJ and I discussed off camera,
yeah.
Is the problem of not bringing a backup bottle, which I didn't, and I meant to, and I didn't. So that's on me. But this wine, which I literally just had last night, and it was gorgeous. So this is a from Domaine de Villan, mm-hmm. Aubert de Villan's personal, you know, winery that he and his wife founded in the 1970s in Bouzeron, makes terrific Aligoté, Ruy, and this particular wine, which the 2019, I know it's a warm vintage and it is definitely ripe, but to me it's so beautifully balanced, mm-hmm. and the wine that I had last night was gorgeous, and this wine is pre-boxed, and you know, I'm going to get back to the retailer who I purchased this from not so long ago, who has been a guest on your show. Yeah. Because it's nothing like the wine that I had last night. So,
and that's been an issue with Burgundy, mm-hmm. Starting like in the early 2000s. It's funny because we talked about a little bit when we opened the bottle, but there's people who would love this because it is that oxidative. Mm-hmm. But I was expecting nice cut. You know what I mean?
I'm only here to disappoint you.
No, not at all.
All right, coming back with another bottle.
All right, I love the sentiment, so thank you so much. I like to start at the beginning, Letty. So where are you from?
Well, I was born in South Bend, Indiana.
Oh, wow.
I'm a Hoosier. And I've lived, and then basically we moved around a lot in the Midwest and a little bit in the South. Not because my dad was in the Army, as many people would guess then, but because he was actually in the glass business, tableware, you know, and designing and marketing glassware and working for glass companies.
Like Ball? Isn't Ball out of Indiana?
Yes. He consulted to Ball, but he worked for Indiana Glass. He worked for Anchor Hocking. He worked for Owens, Illinois, Libby Division. He worked for Duran Glass in New Jersey. He worked for Cabin Crystal. He did some consulting. He did consulting for I'm going to mispronounce it. Itala. I think it's a Finnish glass company. My father became obsessed with the Finns to the degree. He was actually more obsessed with Canada, but almost as obsessed, which is a whole other story. We spent all our childhood vacations in Canada. All the American West as a child. He was a member of the Canadian Alpine Club. That was why.
So we
sat in tents and at the bottom, and he went off with his climbing club. But so mostly the Midwest and a little bit in North Carolina.
So South Bend is, I believe, home of Notre Dame, right?
Yes, but I was only a year old when they left.
Okay, so you left your old.
No ties.
Where do you, what's the first place you live that you kind of remember?
Or like, want to remember?
We can get an LA.
New York.
Buddy, we got a lot of podcasts to fill here.
Are you insinuating there's not enough about my life that's interesting?
Oh, it's plenty about your life, but
with me.
I love I'm fascinated by glass, part. Like, we'll get into like wine glasses, but it just kind of informs conversation. So, you mentioned North Carolina then, but like where'd you kind of go, like to kindergarten through K through five or something like that, was it literally bouncing around?
Okay. It was literally bouncing. That would be painful. But it was one school to.
That's when you get to a writer once you write it. Literally bouncing would
take everything completely literally. It's an asset and a liability. And the problem was, and this is probably one of the ways that I became a writer, is I spent a lot of time in libraries as well, because if you're always the new kid in school, it's hard to break in. People have gone, especially it was my last 2 years of high school. That was when my dad got a job in Indiana Glass, and we moved to this is probably the place that shaped me the most. Was the middle of nowhere, Indiana.
Okay.
And my dad bought. I remember my grandmother was very disapproving, the English teacher who was also disapproving of me. But she said, you know, your father's moving you out in the middle of nowhere. But my father was an autodidact. Like he did go to college, but he taught himself how to repair English sports cars. He taught himself how to, because we lived out in the middle of nowhere, he bought an MGB GT. Mm-hmm. He figured out how to fix it. And Vandeplas Princess, he could fix any, he could lay a floor. He could, you know, he could design a wine glass. Like, you know, he put himself through college. He just knew how to do things. And so when he found this house out in the middle of nowhere, it was 1876. I have this vision of my father. It was like the wealthiest man in Ridgeville, Indiana's house. And it had a cupola, which, you know, and I know I'm super digressing, but my dad fell in love with it because you could go up to the cupola with a glass of wine and survey like the entire farmland around you. Mm-hmm. And we bought what we called a farm, which was 12 acres. And that was, for me, it was a tragedy as a teenager to come into junior year of high school where everyone's grown up to one another. They're all farmers. Right. I was a total oddity, but I was able to get a horse, which was my other great love in life, which has led to the book that I'm just about to publish. But so my dad was like, the bad news is we're going to the middle of nowhere in Indiana. The good news is you can have a horse and a lot of time in a library.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Like the worst, like it's hard. I didn't have this experience, but a lot of my guests and just growing up, like, you want to go, like, you can move around, but I need 4 years of high school. Like, it's like when you come in, all the cohorts, all the cliques are formed.
Right.
And the world, I mean, yeah, bullying wasn't a thing back then. Like, it wasn't a thing that people talked about.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It didn't have a name. It just happened.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it's way of life.
Just get over it.
Yeah.
Hide in your locker.
Right. Hide in your locker, or you're hanging out in the library. But like I said, it played your advantage. Okay, so your dad is really fascinating when you're talking about that too. Different generation. Like, you don't find people who, like, you find, you don't find people who can actually do things. You find people who do a lot of things.
Right.
But like, well, I'm an entrepreneur, so I do. No, we're talking. He did that.
Fixed things.
Yeah, but, he actually fixing like could lay a floor. Like didn't he, like, you know, could fix a British
an MGBG, which is, I mean, I know for a fact he actually he got a hernia because he ended up I seized the engine of that car because I learned to drive in that car.
Yeah.
And the dials were always broken. I assumed that they were broken, but they actually weren't. So the engine was overheating and I destroyed the engine. Oh. So my dad had to single-handedly lift the engine out, and that's when he. Oh. So, anyway.
But even that, he would try that. Like, no one, people like, ah.
He did. Know. I mean, he fixed cars because we were nowhere that sort of car could be fixed.
And like.
Just ordered the parts and figured it out.
Yeah, and this is another thing, too, but like, there was no internet. Like, how did he find a part, right? So, like, literally, I mean, how many MG shops were there in America at that time? 12, LA, New York. I mean, like,
I think
like
Chicago.
Like Chicago, places, right? Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. But so it's insane. Yeah. Like, he had to read like Road and Track or something, and there's an ad in the back, and you got
this is exactly it. Hemmings Motor News,
right. And then you got to order the parts, and it's mail orders, and you know, pre UPS, pre FedEx, slow
gratification or solution. It certainly, I think, made people much more patient and thoughtful. Maybe I don't know, but I mean, I was a kid, so I wasn't paying that much.
So speaking of kid. Any siblings, brothers, sisters?
I have an older sister. Okay. She does designs home furnishings. Yeah.
So okay.
Artistic side.
Okay. Well, his writing's artistic, right?
Oh, yes, but I guess I think of words and pictures.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right.
I'm just words. I mean, aside from a foray into cartooning. Yes.
How much older is she? You said
she's two.
Okay. But were you too close?
Too close. Too close. You know, when you're 2 years apart and you're girls, you know, I remember my sister, I don't know if she wants me repeating this, but I think when we were young, I know when we were young, but I remember her saying, "You are the smart one and I'm the pretty one."
Oh, man. Yeah, times
like,
wow, are
how
different.
How does that age? I know. <That's> like... No, for the record, she's smart too.
That's pretty fun. And where did your grandmother live? Because you said she was...
Oh, well, she was born in Nebraska.
Okay.
And she was she grew up in Nebraska, graduated University of Nebraska, as did my grandfather. And then they moved around a lot as well.
Okay.
When they lived in Chicago, my grandfather and she divorced. She ended up moving to North Carolina because her sister, my great aunt, and her husband were both professors at the University of North Carolina. And so that's where my mother went to college. My father went to college. Like basically, my whole family went to UNC except me.
Okay.
Because that's another story. But anyway, so she got a job teaching high school. James Taylor was one of her students,
wow.
Famously. So she was much beloved, but she was really mean. she saved all her love for students. She was a very critical woman. But that was, I mean, I think, like, you know, when things happen to you as a child, you know, either you not you you it you. I mean, I do believe this. It is character building. If you,
yeah.
I mean, not to gloss over. Over things that are actually very difficult, but you know, instead of saying, "Oh, you know, my grandmother doesn't like me," I was like, "I'll prove to you that I'll be a writer."
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I think about like first of all, she's a woman who went to college when a lot of other women went to college,
right? Like in the 20s.
Yeah, like that's hardcore, you know. And then getting divorced, like, you know,
that was a very big deal. She had 3 children, and yeah. Yeah, she never got married again. I think she was scarred.
She was done?
My grandfather wasn't. He's the eternal optimist.
And then a professor at UNC. And it's So it's funny because she told you not to be a writer, but like that's like she dealt in words. Like, there has to be some genetic, something to do, you know, just a little bit.
It was very interesting because actually at the time she had a house in Chapel Hill. She had this big, beautiful house where we'd go every summer. And that was because we moved around so much. That was a constant.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to write a little newspaper, a local newspaper, you know, describing it was one of my, I don't know if you were a kid, maybe this is Harriet the Spy. It was.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So remember how Harriet the Spy. Oh,
I'm
no,
just thirsty.
No, you're on.
I'm just thirsty. Isn't that your fault? Listen.
Where's the.
It's okay. Every now and then, you're going to go to a really expensive white burgundy tasting, and the ball's going to taste like this, and everybody's like, oh, you're going to You're going to get hazelnuts.
And you're like,
marzipan.
What sommelier are you a restaurant chef? I would be avoiding your service. yes, you know, on a side note, I have been to a certain, or more than one, actually, very famous restaurant where the sommelier has served a corked wine. And I've said, the wine is corked. Mm-hmm. And there's like, and like, it really is. Yeah. It really is. So I want, you know, oxidative is one thing. You can say it's a taste.
Right.
I mean, it is.
Yeah. It's not my preferred. Mm. Don't get me wrong, but I'm just sipping. No. But yeah, no, that's a whole other thing. I'm sure we'll get into.
Okay, I'll save that for later.
No, no, okay. Yeah, it's fine. I bounce around, not literally.
Okay.
Conversation.
I'm hoping you will by the end of this.
I'll be bouncing off the wall.
Might freak out.
Might be some exorcist action. Like, but yeah, that whole thing when you order a bottle of wine so often. Mm-hmm. The psalm gives you attitude instead of just making it rain. Is
less. I mean, it's to their credit. It happens very infrequently, certainly in this country.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Like, and then they don't know who you are.
They don't care. You know.
All right. So you mentioned that your dad bought the property because there was a place he could take a glass of wine. He could survey all 12
and it was
acres.
A big house that needed a lot of work. So we did that ourselves. And it had 12 acres. So, and there was a big barn that I spent the summer cleaning out. They had cows. So I spent that whole summer cleaning out the cow barn so I could have my horse there. And then we had another barn.
What does that entail? Does that entail shoveling shit? Does that entail like literally pitchfork and...
Unfortunately, hence the reason why I would not like to job cleaning.
Yeah, okay.
I feel like I've done a lot of that.
I understand. I don't like to clean my house now because when I grew up, that was every Saturday.
And I
washed dishes or dried them every night. And I'm like, we have a wash. I told my wife, we have a dishwasher. I'm not washing.
Oh, you did? Oh, I didn't have one.
No. We do now.
Oh, okay. But growing up,
I was a dishwasher.
Oh, yes, yes.
Or the dryer.
Right. That was the children's job. How about I had to not only wash the cars, but wax them? Remember back in the day?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, waxing cars.
Car wax.
Who waxes cars? Who makes their children wax cars?
Mr. Miyagi and your parents.
I'm glad it's a small group.
Yeah, no, I never had a wax car. Yeah, wash car.
Do you live in wax cars anymore? Is that a thing?
Yeah, they, it's called detailing now. It costs a lot of money.
Oh, right. Well, for me, it was just free labor.
Yeah, exactly. It's
3 hours much every better. Saturday.
Yeah, man, that's like, woof. And you probably didn't have the electric buffer either.
No, and you couldn't be in the sun, right? Because then the wax would harden.
Harden, yeah.
Okay, this is a big tangent.
Well,
back to the program.
But, you know.
Are you all about tangents?
I'm all about tangents.
I like that.
Because for me, wine allows us to go off on tangents and enjoy it and come back. Mm-hmm.
You're just trying to escape my Premux wine.
I know. So was there wine on the table growing up?
You know, there was, but it was cheap. And we lived in the Midwest. And at that time, there was Gallo. There was Gallo pink Chablis, I remember, and white Chablis. And there was my very first wine when I was 16 was Boone's Farm Tickle Pink, which I don't even think was a wine.
No,
it's probably like apple juice.
Yeah, it was
fermented apple juice.
It was something. They called it wine, but it's only like 6% alcohol or something. It's an alcoholic beverage.
Right. What was the name like with tickle in the name?
Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't suggest
pink stories. Tickle. When you talk about
tickle
Gallo,
pink.
The tickle pink.
Pink.
Oh my God. Tickle pink.
Don't confuse me.
I know. I don't have dyslexia, but apparently
I
do.
Maybe you just like to rewrite
exactly.
The name. Justly so.
The Gallo wine, though. Mm. The Gallo Hardy Burgundy.
Which still exists.
Was back in the 70s, it was a lot of old vines Zinfandel. Mm-hmm. It was actually, I mean, it was a big jug, but... And
Paisano, right?
Yeah, Paisano, yep. Yeah, other old vines. And, I think Paisano still...
I think they actually have it. We could do a tasting.
We should run
out and get a jug.
I know.
I think in this neighborhood.
I'm definitely, there's a liquor store on 37th. You could definitely...
I could run out. Pause this, right? I owe you.
So, also, but with the... What kind of, how did you eat growing up? Just standard American fare?
You know, standard Midwestern fare, okay. I'd say. You know, I'm hard pressed to think we had any fish. I think until
meat, potatoes.
Grew up, very much meat and potatoes. Maybe. And my mother was a very average cook, but she was a really good baker. So okay. It was really pretty ordinary.
Religion, because I was thinking, so you can't be Catholic because you didn't eat fish for Lent, right? Mm. Okay, so.
Well, maybe if it was frozen, I guess we could, right?
Yeah.
Episcopalian.
Okay. No. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, just curious.
Which is, I guess, watered down Catholicism, right?
Yeah, as in everything? except for, no, let me take a minute to, yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. I know I'm not making fun of or denigrating Judaism or Islam, but most American religions or most other religions came from Catholicism. Like, right. Yeah, I don't want to do that anymore, so I'll start my own religion.
Right. How were you?
Jehovah's Witness.
Jehovah's Witness.
So very hardcore.
Yeah. Is there singing in Jehovah's Witness?
Dad singing.
Was there?
Yeah, it's not like black church singing.
Right.
It's just like, it's probably drier than Episcopalian hymns.
No, but you know, the Episcopalian, that's one of the things that I liked about the religion, the beauty of the hymns. And I was actually like low level choir singer.
Okay.
In my youth. And that literally mean that I started out soprano 2 and got to alto 2 in a very short period of time. And then I got booted out altogether. I wasn't that good.
Mom was a good baker.
Mm. Yep.
What was her thing? Did she make pie crust, the whole deal? Get out her lard or her Crisco cookies?
Cookies, really good cookies. Pound cake. But she also was she worked. She was a teacher. She was a second grade teacher. So she wasn't, you know, home.
So wasn't saying she was a homemaker. She wasn't.
She did her best.
You know, yeah. With the apron and.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Did she have an apron? I didn't inherit one. No, I don't think so. But, you know, it was pretty basic. But then it was kind of a basic food era, right?
Remember,
it was like cans of things and frozen.
That whole period was margarine, not butter.
Right.
It was canned vegetables, not frozen fresh. TV dinners became a big thing because mothers were working.
That was a privilege, and right?
We thought that was delicious.
You
got your Salisbury steak.
Same time. That was very exciting.
It's wild. I mean, because I'll be 56 in June, but we didn't drink juice. We drank high C or wine, punch fruit drinks.
Oh, really? We had milk or water. Good for you.
Yeah.
Better for you. But, you know, the one thing that my father did do, I mean, it was very, they liked to set a table. And we always had candles on the table, which really irked my grandmother. She would go, to see my food. I mean, she just was a grouchy woman and, you know, full stop. But my dad, you know, would have, so you would sit down to a meal and you would talk and you wouldn't get, and this was the other, you wouldn't get up from the table until the last person was finished. And that was always my father who would talk and talk and talk. And it's funny because I remember as a kid, it's like, this meal is lasting forever. Can we just get up and, you know, I want to go read a book or watch television. And now I've become that person. Mm-hmm. And my husband's like, but I feel like, you know, we'd sort of slow down because there's so much that we do that's so fast-paced, right? I feel like the one thing they want to do is make a meal last. Yeah. So at this way, you know, so many years later, I can understand now why my father was doing that when at the time it just seemed so incredibly irksome. Like, you know, let me go.
Right. Like, you want me to watch TV? There was I think it's the slow food movement is exactly about that. Mm-hmm. Just sitting down, eating mindfully. Enjoying company of the people you're with.
Right. How often do you sit down to dinner with your wife? We used to sit down
at a table all the time, but now it's become, because we usually eat around 7:30. So it's basketball season. She likes basketball Mondays. So it's like, we're watching for the TV. No. Yeah, we're watching, you know, TNT. We're watching the countdown, NBA countdown. Okay.
Is she a Knicks fan?
No, she is.
What is she?
She's not really a fan. She likes basketball.
Oh, she's okay. Oh,
so right. Like, so
the game. The game.
So like, but you know, that's what she would say. But then like, we somehow never root for the same team. So that's why I find it. I think whoever you're not. She's gonna root against
the opposition. Yeah. Okay.
So I was rooting for
you
the Warriors.
Money on it?
No, I was rooting for the Warriors. She's rooting for the Knicks, okay. Right? You know. Dallas was playing somebody. I was rooting for Philadelphia. She's rooting for Dallas, right?
Right.
She'll go, I like Doncic or I like Joker.
Right.
I'm like, Whatever. You got to be a fan. You got to pick a team, and you got to go through the pain of being a fan.
Exactly. You can't just like switch your allegiance when the team is down. Yeah. You know, speaking of basketball, I did have the great good fortune to meet Coach Pop last year after many years of course, and you know that. I imagine he would be.
He's a dream.
He's a dream. He's such an exceptional man. We sat down maybe for half an hour. It was right before the game last year. And so my point of that is not just to say, hey, I met Coach Pop, but to say, hey, I met Coach Pop. But he, his team is the only team that I will root for against the Knicks, just because, you know, his knowledge of wine is legion. I mean, the fact that he has brought up players, not just brought up players to be great players, but also great men and men who really understand and appreciate wine. And of course, Tony Parker, you know, went on to now has I don't know how many different wine projects at this point. And, you know, he's just one of my heroes for so long. And it's interesting, as I'm reading this book about the Knicks right now, I didn't realize that when Jeff Van Gundy was the coach in the 90s, that Popovich was one of the coaches they're talking about, you know, having him replaced. That they were, that his job was in jeopardy too. Like, Coach Pop's job was in jeopardy. Anyway, sorry, that was a big
No, question. No, I love it. No, it's because I think about that too. I think about people like, that's a guest, that's an interview I definitely would love to do because he's kind of, and from what I've read, he's kind of guy who really brought wine to the NBA because, like you said, these are young men who, most of them didn't come from homes that had wine.
Right.
Take them out to a nice restaurant.
Right. And it's not just about wine.
Exactly.
It's about sitting in a meal and understanding, you know, what things are at a table and exposing them to great food.
And I've worked with kids from Tennessee, and why do we have two forks? I've had kids, like, they don't.
Right.
Because they've not, wasn't brought up that way. Right. And so for him, being a coach was, like I said, grooming these young men, make them better men. And that's an organization. Very little comes out of that organization of scandal. Like, they seem to vet their players really
meaning
well.
The Spurs.
Yeah,
very much so. And he and I first were in touch when I wrote a column, this is maybe 4 years ago, about A to Z Wineworks, which I always thought, you know, they do, I mean, the four founding partners are just wonderful people. I didn't realize that Coach Pop was sort of a hidden, you know, investor from the very beginning, but they met when he traveled to Oregon in the late 90s, just because he's because he's a wine guy and he'd never been to Oregon, and so they went around and at the time they were thinking about starting A to Z, which I always thought had one of the best deals, you know, just terrific Pinot Noir at a basic, you know, like
the Pinot Noir, the Pinot Gris, the Pinot Gris is a great food wine, and they're under $20.
Right, I mean. And unfortunately, you know, it's since been sold and the original partners they do it. But the fact that he Coach Pop also believes, and this is my sort of belief about wine that informs how I write my column and how I think about wine in general. Like, you know, although Coach Pop's salary and his and his cellar are far more substantial than my own, he also appreciates like a not pre-ox, but you know, a Ruhi, you know, and not necessarily a Morche. So, you know, drinking basic wine.
Saint Aubin.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Some of these village wines. Yeah.
It's getting expensive though.
I know. Well,
I used to think it was affordable for wine journalists, and it's like $80 and way up. Not so much.
Yeah. You got to find, nowadays, it's finding a really good McCall.
Yep. Yep. And Puy Fousse.
Yeah.
And Puy Fousse. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's time to go to college. Where do you go?
I went to Kenyon College in Ohio, famous for its English department, which is because I wanted to be a writer. And then spent my junior year, and this is how I got into the world of wine. I spent my junior year in Ireland, studying Irish literature, history, and politics. And the funny thing was, at the time, I was like, should I spend an urban semester in Philadelphia or Ireland? And my father said, that's a no-brainer. Go to Ireland.
Yeah.
And actually, the family I lived with, the father was a wine merchant. And I know you started out in retail. Yep. As did I. That was my first job because when I lived with Peter, his name is Peter Dunn, and he's still the director of Mitchell & Son, which is still the leading wine merchant. But in Ireland, as I'm sure you know, in the UK, you can be a merchant, you can be a retailer, you can be a wholesaler, you can be a distributor. They had a wine bar. And so I would hang out at the wine shop and I would hang out at the wine bar. And I just thought, this is like, you know, wine to me, it was like literature. It was talking about wine, like you know, people, like you would discuss novels. And so I actually, when I came back to school and graduated, I thought, I want to be, and this was so ridiculous, I want to be in the wine business without even knowing what that was. But it gave me something to say when I was walking around campus. I'm going to be in the wine business. Yeah. Like, sounds great, Letty.
It does sound.
But I just started writing letters to wine companies and one of them, I don't know, is this what you, shall I keep unspooling or do you want
to? Yeah, no, I'm loving this.
Okay, so one of the companies that I wrote was then, it was Mosswood Wine Company. Gerald Asher was the president. Gerald Asher, who was also the wine columnist of Gourmet Magazine,
okay,
who had also written a book. I can't remember the name of it, but I'd read about his early years as a wine retailer. And Gerald is such a gorgeous writer, and he made the retail wine business sound so romantic. I thought, oh, and so I'll never forget, I went in to interview at the company, and this wonderful man named Rainier Van Tine, long since, you know, passed. And he said, yeah, but what do you know about, he said, where's Rosalind Heights? And I just moved to New York. I'm like, I have no idea.
Okay, so you graduated and moved right to New York.
Yeah, sorry, of course, because okay. I thought there are two places you can be in wine, mm-hmm, in America at the time,
yeah.
And that's, you know, in the early 80s, is New York or California. And okay, I thought, you know, I'm not blonde and gorgeous, and that, so I can't go to California, which is what I thought. I'd never been to California. I thought that's where all people are blonde and gorgeous. But I'm spunky and, you know, maybe a bit odd, so I could go to New York, where odd, spunky people go from the Midwest. And my sister was living here too, okay, so I moved in with her in her like studio apartment.
What part of town?
89th Street and between 2nd and 3rd.
Okay.
And it was kind of dodgy then.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, everything was dodgy in the 80s.
Yeah, man, that was hot.
I ended up living in Inwood because that's where I could afford.
Oh, okay. So,
and I used to ride the A train until late at night. But, you know, when you're from the Midwest, you're like, oh, everything's great. And then only later in life, I think, you know, that was a really.
Yeah, you look back at some. I look back at shit I did when I was like.
Exactly. 20, exactly. Because your stupidity of youth,
yeah,
protects you, I guess.
Yeah. No, you know, angels, what is protect fools,
right,
and
right,
drunks.
Right.
You know, I had both covered in my 20s. It was double covered.
You had a lot of angels, yeah, exactly, looking out for you.
Okay, so you, like, I'm sorry, you went in to interview
at various wine wholesalers and, yeah, distributors, and realized that it's, you know, it's, nobody wanted to talk about Pinot Noir. People wanted to talk about sales because it's all about sales, right? It's all about knowing your territory. Yeah. I didn't have a clue, and they said in order to know the wine world, you have to start at retail, and that, so here I was with, you know, I had debt because I had to take out loans. My dad had lost his job, you know, my last year of college, so I had some loans, and I was like, I don't, you know, and all of my friends are going into law school and they're going to publishing or they're going to medical school, like or finance.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a job at what was my parents' at a liquor store, basically.
I know.
Initially, ever so briefly, at Zaki's, I went to college with Jeff Zachariah, who I didn't know at all. Funny, you know, in passing.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I was going back and forth on Metro North, and basically I was being paid, you know, $9 a week and spending that on transportation. I'll never forget, I had an interview at Gray's Papaya Hot Dog Stand on 86th Street and 3rd with this wonderful man, Bonsall Segerman, Freddie Segerman. And he was one of the early importers of Burgundy and great wine estates from France.
Mm-hmm.
And Freddie Segerman said, and he bought me a hot dog, and he said, you should go work for my friend Roberta Morrell. And I thought, well, you know, at least their shop is in New York, so I don't have to pay commutation on Metro North.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to work for the Morrells for just over a year and got an incredible education. I worked with some remarkable people, and I really, you know, gained an understanding of the wine business. And then while I was there, this wonderful man, Rainier Van Tine, who I'd interviewed with at Mosswood, came in and he said, Letty, what are you doing here? And I said, you told me to work retail. So I came to work retail. And he said, come talk to me. And so he hired me in my first job in wine wholesale. And it didn't last very long. because it involved typing.
Oh my God.
I was a terrible typist. So they actually gave me, he said, you know, Letty, we really like you. You had to type invoices because that's what salespeople in training did. And he was like, you're making a lot of mistakes. I said, I'm not really a typist. And so they were so nice. He said, well, that's what sales trainees do. They have to understand like the you had to understand inventory. And so after less than a year, they fired me, but gave me a cake and a going away party.
Oh, that's sweet.
Because they liked me. That was one of my many misbegotten moves in wine wholesale, because I just, you have to be a certain kind of person. I wrote about this, actually. It's one of my most favorite columns I wrote about when I was the wine columnist of Food & Wine magazine. People have still, in the wine wholesale world, have told me they still read this. It was about what it takes to be a great wholesale wine salesperson. Maybe you were not, but I didn't have any of the things that you, first of all, I had no great territory, because when you're young, you know, but second of all, I would always take no for an answer. Third, I would you don't like it? Okay, that's fine. Which is not what a salesperson does. But I met these three salespeople. They worked at the time for Martin Scott.
Martin Scott.
And this woman, Deirdre, oh my God, she was a force. She was, first of all, she had these incredible architectural, I know I'm jumping all over, but this is like many years later when I'm the wine columnist and presumably, you know, things are looking up because I'm a journalist and not a salesperson, which I was very bad at, although I like retail. So this woman, Deirdre, and I'm trying to remember the other two salespeople for Martin Scott, they had great portfolio, Martin Scott, great Burgundy portfolio particularly. And Deirdre would just walk into like Restaurant Danielle and say, okay, you can have this and this and this, and you can't have that. And like, and they would just like, okay, you know, and she had great territory, great authority, great knowledge, you know, great French accent. And so I wrote a column about following her and these other two gentlemen whose names currently escape me, and what they had that I didn't have, starting with great territory and great portfolio. But then when I came to the journal, fast forward many years later, and I followed this young guy, Eric Clemens, around for Core Wine Company. He was the youngest salesperson, I think, for Michael Skernick. And he wanted to start his own company. And so I followed him around because, you know, what it took then to be successful, you know, successful importer and distributor, it was remarkably the same, something like 15 years on. You know, here he was with the suitcase and, you know, and that completely unglamorous life and doing all the things that I saw, you know, Deirdre do, but now he was, you know, like he was the young aspiring, you know, and he'd actually read my column that I'd written years ago about Deirdre. Because, you know, the business fundamentally hasn't changed.
Well,
see those guys, you know, dragging the suitcases.
I mean, you're on a subway, you got your big thing and your suitcase on wheels.
It's remarkable.
You're locking around. It's very low tech. I mean, it's more high tech now because you have a Cora van. That's the high tech part about it. Because you're like, I'm going to pour through these samples, right? Like, but like Sam, you don't have to worry about your samples going so bad so quickly. I want to talk about, because I say this a lot. I've said it from the outset. I know about wine because I worked retail. I don't get myself in trouble, but like I'm gonna offend some people. But like the whole point of and I was in a conversation on Instagram started yesterday, Karen McNeil. We'll talk about it. By the way, we want to issue at Beats Vines and Life, formerly the Black Wine Guys. We want to make a correction. There are three full time.
Maybe more.
There might be.
Maybe we don't.
But you should raise your hand. But that okay, three major wine critics you have.
Columnists.
We have Letty Teague. We have Eric Asimov, and we have Esther Mobley. And I think why that slipped by both of us is the journal. I know about it because your predecessor, Dottie and John. But like when you think of you think Times, you in the journal, you're like, oh, that's the Wall Street paper, but it's not. Like
we're actually the Wall Street Journal, and nobody knows this in New York City, but we're substantially larger than New York
Times. Oh, I believe that.
You go outside of New York and you see the Wall Street Journal everywhere.
When I was in college, in my political sci class, we had one of the requirements for getting the silver. You had to get a subscription to the Wall Street Journal. Like that was a paper we read.
Right, right.
Not the Times.
And it's not just. I mean,
not USA Today.
Does USA Today even exist anymore?
Oh, no.
I remember they had a wine writer long ago.
Yeah.
They Jerry, lovely guy. What was his name? Jerry something. But, you know, the journal, of course, has changed dramatically. So I've been there now 14 years. When I joined, there was just Weekend Journal. And then there was Personal Journal. And then there was, you know, now there's Mansion. And there's Exchange. And there's Review. So the journal, you know, and I think that's why the journal has grown to the degree that it has, because there's so much more. I mean, there's the core audience, yes, of course, and there's incredible financial reporting and investigative reporting, but, you know, the journal is not just, you know, finance, although it's great finance.
But to the point about retail, anyway, like that's a great way to learn about wine. Like,
absolutely.
So I think, and someone who's grossly overeducated who doesn't use their degree.
Mm. that would be you.
Yeah, that'd be me. I've had Mary Ewing Mulligan, who runs the wine cinema.
She's great.
She's incredible.
She's great.
But there is this thing you talk about, like he said, go work retail, and you did it. Mm-hmm. Like, people be like, well, I have my WCT 1 or 2. I'm a wine educator. I don't have to work retail. I'm like, working retail, you get to taste so many wines.
Why would you want to?
Right. There's going to be 12 wines on your exam. Right, and so right. Get a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Right. Like, literally, it's right. like, just wines are just around you, and you and producers come in, and salespeople come in, and some of the salespeople, besides the sales, they'll talk to you and explain stuff to you. Like, it's just this portal. And then people forget, before the commoditization of the education of wine, I mean, wine education has become a commodity nowadays. I mean, it's
right.
But right. in general, right? Right. Colleges right. don't lower
programs.
Tuition. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certificate programs, and, you know, people be like, University of Phoenix has produced more PhDs in 20 years than the. I have a real live law.
No, I meant
Rutgers University.
In addition,
yeah, no.
Just like an add-on. Yeah.
No,
like you could do that in your spare time.
I could, you know,
over the weekend. Get
yeah,
a PhD.
It says that it's like on your exams on your schedule. I'm like, yeah, there's
like
no skin in the game.
Grades as you would like them.
But
what do you like your grade to be?
The fact that you did that, right? Like. Mm-hmm. You went to a great school. Kenyon's a great school, right. Great liberal arts college.
Right.
And you fell in love with wine. And you're like, I'm going to work in wine.
Right.
And you actually did go to work in wine. Like
I did. I worked in restaurants and wholesale and retail. And you know what? But the thing is, MJ, can I call you MJ or Marvin?
Yeah,
some
MJ.
People are calling you Marvin.
No, that's so.
That's
so
your,
just
that's
so you know.
Formal name.
My formal name, right. That's when you're writing checks.
Okay.
So because I have to have a credit card on file, that's why they go by my name. But you know, and also I have a lot of new people. But MJ is
what's the J?
Marvin John.
Marvin John.
So
hyphenated?
No.
Oh,
my father's name is Marvin. And then I have a cousin who's 5 years older whose name is Marvin. Mm-hmm. They didn't know I was coming. So
we're like, whoever shows up.
Well, you know, it was my dad. And so you know, there was no way I was not going to be named after him.
I
come to find out because I have this name, but he didn't have a middle name. So my mom would call me Marvin John or MJ. So
that's why
I use MJ.
I like that.
She passed,
and
when the podcast started after she passed, and my ability to sit here and do this is all my mother. She had the best personality. She's funny as hell.
Oh wow!
She's very you know,
wow.
Best handwriting ever. Like,
really?
things that you take for granted. Yeah. Oh my God.
Really? Do you have a sample of her handwriting?
I'll send you some.
I want to see it.
Yeah. You'll be like,
I was just talking about the other day that the cursive, the lost art of cursive.
Oh, yeah.
And especially if your mother had beautiful handwriting.
Yeah.
Even when people were writing cursive, nobody really had beautiful handwriting.
Yeah. No, she actually had, it's unbelievable.
Mm.
But so, yeah, MJ. So, But yeah, no, the willing to work and start about not like, well, I went to Kenyon College. I'm not going to stock shelves at your wine store.
Well, I mean, but let us also be realistic. Back in the day, and well, I was about to say there weren't that many clear paths. There was enormous opportunity. Think about all the people that started, you know, wine importing companies at that time, you know, like Michael Skernick, for example, was, he was a salesperson for Momassan when I met him. But, you know, Michael's gone on to build a behemoth of a company.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was a really entrepreneurial guy, and there was the opportunity, you know, for an entrepreneurial guy to go out to create this portfolio, just like, you know, Kermit had done a generation before him, and then Terry Teese and all these guys who, you know, like they, I mean, I, you know, I feel like there was so much opportunity for entrepreneurship of a certain sort, if you're willing to, you know, I mean, I remember Michael, you know, like, I mean, Momassan was not like a hot commodity. I remember Momassan Clos de Tarte, you know, it wasn't like, that was not a prestige product. Although I guess at the day, maybe it was, but you know, people, you had to sort of figure out how you're going to go about it, how you're going to go about. And I made a lot of, left turns that I used to joke that looked like I was never going to have a proper job until I got this from my first job at a magazine and thought, okay, this is where, this is what I'm meant to be doing. I took an enormous pay cut to do that. But I thought editing and writing, and I had just come out with Fear of Wine. So I had this wine book, although it was a cartoon that I had done. But, what I'm leading up to is that when I became the wine editor of Food and Wine magazine in 97, women were, it was very uncommon, for a woman to be the wine editor. There was a lot of skepticism and a lot of what's the word that I want? It was a very male dominated field, and so there, it was and Bob Parker was actually one of the writers that I then edited before I started Column, and I'm very friendly. Bob is a great guy, and he was always just wonderful to work with. But the way that I was able to establish my legitimacy as the wine editor is like, well, I've been in wholesale sales. I've been in retail sales. I've worked in a restaurant. I've been an assistant manager of restaurants in New York. Like I have a fundamental understanding of the business. And I think that, that did to a certain degree, address the inherent sexism that still exists in the industry. I don't have to tell you that, much less so it's fantastic. You have, some top women, sommeliers, women, writers, women,
Martine importers.
Not so many importers. I was just going to say.
Night Sailor, Becky Wasserman.
But that's a whole, right. I'm talking about new generation, right? Yeah. Like where's the female equivalent of Eric Clemens, those guys, and I feel like that's the business side of things. Maybe women haven't been as, and I don't know why that is. I want someone to explain that to me because I'm intrigued, that the business side doesn't seem to be something that women have made. Winemaking, yes. So yes, yeah. Hugely winemaking. Yeah. Not to say it isn't a business.
Well, this is a good point. To take a quick break. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Letty Teague.
Can I run out and get you another bottle of wine?
You cannot. So nice try, Letty. We'll be right back with more Letty. So we'll be right back.
Hey, I don't know if I told you guys this earlier, but last year, Grenache Fest sold out within 72 hours. So if you want to be there on November 8th, 2024, make sure that you go over to GrenacheFest.com and sign up for the email list so you will be the first to know when tickets go on sale. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. This was a one-of-a-kind wine and music festival like no other I've ever seen before. Don't miss out. Go to GrenacheFest.com for more information.
Okay, we're back. Letty did not run out to get another bottle.
But I wanted to.
She didn't want to. So talk about that. You said the first wine. So a couple things. You're talking about Michael Skirnick. Two things that people have in common. So I had Kevin Zraley on,
Oh, how fun.
He was great. Yeah. He's, again, the reason we have Wine Education America is Kevin Zraley, and he doesn't have a WSET anything.
Right. He just did the work.
He's just study, it's a study. You can, mm-hmm. But that being said, he talked about Michael, and people don't understand, Michael went to work at Wine Owners of the World, learned about wine. Like, it was a big pay cut. There are risks. Like, there's, you better love this, right? But Michael knew what he had a plan. He's like, he knew I'll do this for 2 years. Apparently, he knew what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. But Kevin tried to talk him out. He's like, mm-hmm. Michael, you got a family. You got a kid. You can't take a pay cut.
It turned out well.
So what was that first job as an editor?
It's a magazine that no longer exists. Okay. It was called Diversion, the travel and leisure magazine for physicians. Published by Hearst. And that... I think when was this? 1995, maybe. And I think I made $30,000. I was married at the time, so right. There was okay, the wolf is not at the door. Right. But I was I edited all the food, wine, and books section of the magazine. And that's when I had connected. And that's when it was before I started writing anything wine-wise. But I connected with Matt Kramer, whose writing I'd always admired. You know, and he's one of Matt's, you know, under his understanding wine. Is that Matt's? Because he has a series of books. I don't know if his books are still in print, but they certainly should be. He was one of the writers I, you know, admired at the Wine Spectator. So I had him start writing a column, mm-hmm. you know, a regular column. And then I actually was there for about a year. And then I went off to write a book that didn't work out, but I wrote a freelance story for Food & Wine magazine called Why I Hate to Eat with My Husband. And I was married at the time to Alan Richman, the man that's won more James Beard Awards than any human being alive. I think it's like 26 or some insane amount. You know, and Alan was the restaurant critic for GQ and you know, just an amazing, amazing writer. And he was having dinner with Dana Cowan, then the editor-in-chief of Food & Wine, longtime editor. And that's how, So I wrote the piece. They thought it was hilarious. It was funny. We were photographed at Four Seasons, you know, and you know, it's funny because Alan was photographed. You know, the piece ran in Food & Wine magazine, and Dana and Alan had dinner, and she said, "We're looking for a wine editor. Do you know anyone?" And Alan told me, and I said, "Well, what about me? You know, I'd had all this wine experience." She had no idea. We met, and it was the longest interview process I've ever gone through. It took 3 months. I met everyone, many of whom are still my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, Food & Wine. And I was actually just about to go to Nebraska, take my mom to Nebraska, because I'd never been to Nebraska. And then I had to, and then they called and we said, you know, 3 months later, we want to offer you the job. And I said, "Oh, sorry, can't go to Nebraska." And that's when I started in May of 97 as the wine editor, and later became the wine columnist and the executive wine editor. Right? And started the whole wine coverage. There was virtually no wine coverage in Food & Wine. Started the Wine Awards program, started, you know, the only thing there was an alternating column between Steve Tanzer and Robert Parker. And that was it. And then I would chase after other people to write some things. And I was doing a little writing, and Dana said, "You're a really good writer. Why don't you just write a wine column?" And I thought, you know, really me? And that started in 2000. So it's been ever since then. But that was one of the more remarkable twists of fate, I think, which I feel like is sort of like life. You know, like if you're willing, you know, there's always luck involved in life, right? And good
people don't want to talk about that.
But it's so much luck involved in life. I mean, you do all that you possibly can to increase your luck.
Well, you should.
But there's also a very big luck factor.
Like, you know, when you say that, like the wine world is really small, in all honesty. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, like, so you Tanzer wrote for you, like, during that first season I had on, God damn it, Molesworth, James Molesworth. He got a job because his like Tanzer's wife was a professor and worked with like his mom, like at Queens College.
Right.
Steven didn't know, but I'm like, you wrote it. Like, he wrote a letter of recommendation. He got a job at a wine store, like, and then you know you worked with Tanzer, like it's and then like I've interviewed Lisa Parati Brown a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. She worked with Parker, and same thing. Everybody, this is the thing. Everybody who I know who's worked with Parker thinks he's great. He got vilified by a certain section of Psalm section or something for.
I think by people elevating their reputations based on their antipathy to what it was that he represents. I don't think anyone, and I would bet, you know, the farm, anyone who's actually met Bob would say anything negative about.
That's the sense I've gotten.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. I mean, now obviously long retired, and I've spent certainly when I was his editor at Food & Wine, and then later in later years, he was the one that introduced me to Park B. Smith, who gave me one of the, you know, shared some of the most memorable wines I've ever had in my life. You know, the great, he owned Veritas. I don't know if you ever went there back in the day, which is how, that was actually my first James Beard Award was following the Psalms at Veritas. Because Veritas in the late, I want to say like 99, 2000, was the restaurant in New York. Tim Kopeck was the, said Josh Nadel was one of the hot, you know, he was hot young Psalms, and hot in the sense of ambitious, not, I mean, sorry, Josh. No, you're good looking too, and Eric Zillier, three great guys, and they were so dynamic. And I shouted them. I've sent it to you because it was so much fun. They were like, and they said they were like the fighter pilots of the wine world.
They're like the Top Gun, like, yeah.
And they had this great, it was hilarious. The chef, why am I spacing on his name? Scott. But he would, they had this thing when people would order silver oak, because they so loathed silver oak that they would bring it by the kitchen and hold the silver oak aloft. And Scott Conant.
It was Conant.
He would say, boo, and they would, the whole kitchen would erupt in boos. And they bring the silver oak out. It was pretty hilarious. And then my last, you know, my last sort of day there, because I spent maybe 2 weeks there to write the column, which is, you know, which was so much fun and a lot of work, as you realize how much time they spend on their feet and how much shoe leather goes on, how many flights of stairs. But I had to be a sommelier, and one of the things that I realized, because, you know, as a casual thing, I'm not, you know, a restaurant professional. I mean, it's like, was you have the art of the even pour of six. So you have a bottle of wine and six glasses,
yep.
And to get it exactly right one time around. And Josh was like, did that woman just suck down an entire glass of wine, or did you give this a really uneven pour, lady? You know, really uneven pour. So just from the you know, the physicality of the job to the finesse of the job, it was so illuminating and compelling and impressive. So that was great fun, and that was sort of early in my writing of the column. But it was a great experience.
Yeah,
much fun.
I'm glad you pointed that out. I think people, the Saw movies were great on one level, but people don't understand like the hard work. Like,
oh my gosh!
Like absolutely. Forget this. Like the study. Like, you know, I've had a lot of people like what they were going through, people, hair falling out, going, you know.
Yeah.
But like, you're on your feet 16 hours a day.
You have to be able to carry. I remember when Tim Kopeck told me, he was interviewing, you know, assistant sommeliers, said, "Can you carry 50 pounds? How, you know, can you lift a box, like, you know, I forget how many times, and can you run up and down the stairs, like, you know, however many times?" Because it was as if they were training for, an Olympic event,
yeah.
Much as they were.
Yeah.
And you also have to know everything there is to know
and smile and be pleasant
and
not lose your cool.
Exactly.
Like, it's a lot.
And when people and a very entitled clientele would come to restaurants.
Well, and that's another thing too. Yeah. That's why I love talking, like, being a winemaker. People are like, oh, I want to be a winemaker. They're like, man, I walk around dirt, you know, cutting your hands. And then there's a lot of waiting around for nothing to happen. Right. And then when it does happen, it's 20 hours a day.
Right. And the economic worry, especially
independent. I mean, you know, independent producers. I don't know if you know Patrick Capiello, former Somme.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, was on Instagram, did a whole series.
I saw that, and he's right.
Very honest and vulnerable, mm-hmm. and, you know, basically saying, like, we're going to be out of business in 2 years if you guys don't support
us. Right.
You know?
Well, I think also, and I think as others pointed out, it's the cost of shipping. Let's talk about the astronomical cost of shipping, because, you know, I mean, it's great, and certainly that is valid, but what really needs to change is, I mean, let's talk about the laws that make it so difficult to send.
Well, we both live in New Jersey. It's the worst. There's places I have to get shipped to New York, and then I got to come pick it up.
You can't get it from New York. You can't get it from California. You can't get it from Washington. You can't, you know, I mean, and the price of getting, you know, wines, even the wines that you can, it's prohibitive to consumers. It's prohibitive to the producers. I mean, everyone's losing, and it's because of these anachronistic laws that, you know, we have in place, and we can spend the whole time talking about that.
That's a whole other podcast.
Yes.
So food and wine, was there a food and wine, like, now they have the festival. It's like, were you part of the genesis of that, or
that was the whole advertising marketing side?
Okay.
You know, and that's been a real difference. You know, when I came to the journal and magazines and newspapers, especially a newspaper like the Journal, which has very, very strict journalistic standards, and which I'm so happy about, is it's very clear. You know, I don't take samples, I don't take meals, I don't take anything for free, and mm-hmm. you know, and let's say the morals at magazines are more elastic, and even more so nowadays, because there is so much emphasis, you know, as magazines continue to get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Oh yeah, well, the rise of the influencer, right? Like, it's literally,
yeah, or when the magazines themselves become like marketing.
Well, they're just marketing books, like, you're like, okay,
marketing a name.
This is one of three big conglomerates. These are all their wines in this issue.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. And, oh, and coincidentally, there's an editorial about that.
Right, 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 right.
Which would never happen. Where I, you know, at a publication with ethics and
things. I missed the good old days of magazines, though. Like, because I mean, like
the '90s, you know, were the golden.
They were the golden age. I mean, because
happy to.
I guess I'm too old. I like. Mm-hmm. I can't like even sometimes if I want to read an article, I got to print it out. I can't just read it on my mm-hmm. computer screen. It's just not the same. I like the.
Do you subscribe to magazines like that arrive to your house and newspapers?
We were getting the Times for a while, but they kept fucking it up. And the customers.
Then you should subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. I believe there are some very fine offers on. Not that I have anything to do with subscribers.
So you did. You probably saw it because you were through 2009, right?
Right, right before so the magazine.
Yeah, so you saw the riot, but you saw the blogs coming. You saw that coming, right? All that online.
There was a. I don't know if you remember, but in like the early aughts, everyone left magazines for tech, you know, opportunities, which then didn't happen, and everyone came back to magazines. Yeah. I mean, I think magazines were really super solid till about 2008 when everything fell apart economically, and nothing really has been quite the same. Everywhere. And really, I mean, and certainly just speaking now specifically of magazines, I mean, so many magazines closed, you know.
Oh my God.
And I mean, I remember looking, I still have copies of Food and Wine from those early days, the early 2000s, and the magazine was fat. And we did fun stories, you know, we did thoughtful essays, and we did, you know, it wasn't just like 12 Cabernets, you know, for $100, you know, for $25 or something. It was more diverse and more far reaching, and it was fun and thoughtful and practical. It wasn't just service or advertiser. And that I think is just sadly, you know, the devolution of magazines in general.
Yeah. So, Wall Street Journal, did they have an ad looking for a writer? Or?
You know, it's very funny. This is a funny story because I heard that they were. I was actually I'd never met Dottie and John. Like, and I, you know, okay. I read their column, and Dottie and I met. I don't know if you a couple of years ago for the very first time. Like and they never went to tastings. Like they were very much in the journal. You know, Wall Street Journal. We don't go to tastings. We don't. You know.
Yeah, I mean, because they were strict journalists. They worked at the Miami Herald. I mean, they were
right.
OG journalists, right?
Like, yeah. No, they had very substantial careers, and. I believe they were, let's see, because I joined in February 2010. They left in December 2009. That's when I heard that they were looking, and various people were auditioning. They were auditioning lots of people. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to send a bunch of column ideas, which I did. And they ran one. And I'll never forget, I was at a dinner. And this man was telling me he got the job at the Journal. He said, you know, I auditioned for the job at the Wall Street Journal. And coincidentally, that was the day that I had gotten a call that they offered me the job. And I was like, it's really interesting.
Did you?
Wonder what happened to him now. I have no idea. But it was amazing. I have to tell you, when I first interviewed at the Journal, and I'd interviewed more than one or so, but it was really, it was like a movie set of what I thought, what a newspaper looks like. And I still do. It's a remarkable place. I mean, there are so many extraordinary journalists that work there, but it's just like the hub, you know, the page one editor sit there, and it's like news of real consequences happening here, and there are really smart people. And I was awestruck, and I thought, why did I want to go in the wine business when I was 21? Why didn't I want to be a journalist? You know, I mean, like, oh, it's too late to be, you know, page one investigative or an investigative journalist. But so I was just I was impressed by the importance of what it was that they did, and I thought, you know, wine is, I mean, that's nice, but you know, like what you're doing is really consequential. And then I've just been, you know, I was hired by. My first editor has now gone on to, she now, I mean, Emily Gitter, she's kept rising. As that's the beautiful thing. Well, many beautiful things at the Wall Street Journal to me is that they promote from within. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of women in positions of authority, like our editor-in-chief, Emma Tucker. Yay, first woman editor-in-chief of the Journal. And also people have stuck around. I mean, of course, there have been layoffs, but there's, you know, it wasn't like magazines. You look at magazines now and everyone is 25 or younger, mm-hmm. you know, and as a journalist at a newspaper, this is true of the Times too. I have friends at the who work at the Times. You don't you I mean experience is prized and is valuable.
Yeah.
And you know, anywhere in the world that that's true nowadays is a good thing. Is you know.
100%. 100%. So you they ran that column and then you started a weekly column. Is that what happened?
You know, in the beginning, it was there were three. Jay McInerney and I alternated.
Yes,
right. And I was always on staff, and he was freelance. And then there was Will Lyons. That was when we had a WSJ Europe. So he was WSJ Europe columnist. Very nice guy, Will. He came from a retail background too. He now writes a column for the Sunday Times of London, I think, right? At any rate, so then Jay, then he actually, and then we had the Greater New York section. So I don't know if you, I mean, it was so much fun. And they said, "Oh, would you like to write a wine story every now and again?" And that was great because it was the journal going, you know, against the Times Metro section, which doesn't exist anymore either. And so the editor of the section at the time said, "Hey, Letty, do you want to write a regular wine column?" So I was actually like added on. I was writing a weekly New York column, which was great fun because I could go anywhere, you know, in the metro area and report stories that weren't of national consequence. But I could go, you know, to this guy had an incredible wine shop just off the boardwalk of Coney Island, and it was like, what is this huge wine story, or somewhere, you know, in New Jersey, like I reported the BYO scene in New Jersey. So things that was great while it lasted. I think it lasted like 7 years, and they closed the section. And then by then, Jay, they didn't renew. I don't know what happened. I guess maybe not renew his contract. But so then I began writing the three columns. And for a brief time, I wrote a column that was basically, it was called Drinking With. Mm-hmm. And it was like drinking with famous people, which was both incredible. It was a lot of fun and incredibly stressful because, you know, that's what people do for a living is wrangle celebrities, right? So here I'm, you know, wine columnist, and people did not want to talk about, famous people did not want to talk about alcohol, right?
I know. I mean, I've had someone who don't want to talk about. I'm like,
right.
But you're a big time Burgundy collector, right? But they don't want to talk about it. Yeah.
But it was actually thanks to Richard Gere. Like when I got Richard Gere, and at the time he had an inn, and he was like, sure, in Westchester, and he was great, and his then wife Carrie, and then I got from him to Itzhak Perlman, to who was lovely and charming, but has very expensive taste in wine.
We used to sell him wine when I worked at Acker.
Did he buy very expensive wine?
Yeah.
He was like very disappointed that I had a budget. He was like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, no, but I didn't. And then the scariest one was Brian Ferry, who is this lovely guy. He has really expensive taste in wine. I ended up with such a big bill. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. It was 10 years ago, so a long time ago, emailing my editor saying, "I just spent a lot of money on dinner because Brian Ferry kept ordering."
But he's like, "Don't pay the ferryman, but you're gonna pay this wine bill."
I was like, and I even traveled down to D.C. It was back when we had a bit more money to meet him because he was on tour. Lovely guy though, and he was one of my heroes. I don't know if you're Roxy Music fan. Nelson DeMille. Yeah, I mean, just fantastic. I mean, there's so many people that I met that way, but it only lasted for a year. I think, you know, A, it was expensive, and B, I mean, you can't both be you'd have to be a full-time celebrity wrangler.
Yeah, no, it is. It's
Randy Newman was one who I really wanted, though. He's a big wine guy, and of course, he's a genius, and he was like, Allison Janning was great. She was really...
Oh, really?
Yeah, she was terrific. It was back when film came out. Anyway, so yes, there are some random famous people and I sat down and drank wine together.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to do is this whole thing was like, who do I want to drink wine with?
Right. Well, I guess not me anymore.
We got a bone to pick. You know who you are.
Yes, the retailer who sold me this Premox.
There you go. Vin Biologique.
It's a little too biologique. Should we hone in on that name?
No, we're not. So talk about, how many books have you written in total?
I was the cartoonist and co-author of Fear of Wine, the author of Wine in Words, the author of Educating Peter, and then my book that's coming out in the spring has nothing to do with wine. It's a biography of a famous children's book author named Marguerite Henry, who wrote Misty of Chico Teague and 58 other books and was one of the most famous children's book authors of her time, sadly forgotten. So called Dear Readers and Writers.
I love it. I love it. Yeah.
What does it take to write a book?
A lot of time.
Besides a lot of time and patience.
Patience.
And command of the English language.
Well, I think, you know, I was thinking about that because I, like my last book that I had this idea, which was not a wine book, because I wanted, you know, because I think you should, like you've done so many things in the wine world and you clearly decided to challenge yourself by starting a podcast, right? So to do something that, you know, I'm betting you had probably never done before. You're like,
nope.
But at some point you have to just jump off and try something, you know, completely different and challenge yourself. And obviously you've done very well. And I sort of felt like I wanted to do something that was not wine. And this idea for this biography of this children's book author who I read as a horse crazy young girl, mm-hmm. and who apparently was still being read, Misty of Chico Teague, by horse crazy young girls. It sort of began 4 years ago, and I started, you know, looking into, and I'm getting around to your question of how does it take to write a book, because there were so many reasons not to do that.
Sure.
Like she was long dead. It was hard to find her correspondence. It was so much work. And I would say about a year into it, I thought, you know, I don't know how I'm going to pull this off. She was not particularly good at keeping correspondence. She never had children, so it was hard to find descendants. Like it was so much work just to get started, just to have enough that I thought this could possibly be a book. And now I look at it and I've just this week gotten blurbs from some amazing writers, like two of them Pulitzer Prize winners who wrote beautiful things because they're one of the only few people who've seen the galley of the book. Mm-hmm. And that, it's like that transformative feeling, wow, all that time was, which it felt like this is not going well. I don't know why I ever decided that I maybe had a podcast where you're like, I don't know why I decided to take this on. This is not going, I don't know, see the end of this. But then when you finally see the end of it, and I think that just to continue going, you know, just to keep going and to keep going and to think, and I think that's, I mean, not to get all, you know, moralistic or anything, but I think just to keep going, you know, sometimes it's just about keeping going and just finishing it. Because I think that, and that's the beauty for me as a columnist, is I have a 1,200 word count, right? And you have a certain amount of time to fill in a podcast. Like it's somewhere you just have to get it done, and you just have to keep going with it and trust that it's going to go well and turn out well.
Yeah, no, it's you know, a lot of words get batted around or bantered around, creator, this content creator. I was talking to someone, I was like, listen, I use social media, but like a post is not the same thing to me. It's not the same thing. Like
an Instagram post?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same thing as, or what tweet, like, comparing it to?
I think, well, when you say creator, people are like, I'm a creator.
That's a very elastic concept.
Very liberally.
I wrote a sentence.
Yeah, exactly. It was snappy and had the right photo and right angle.
If you can make a living at that, God bless.
I mean, you know, but in a world of, you know, ADHD, going back to how you were raised, slow down, eat a meal, reading a paper. Remember, like, one thing I will say, though, is that people complain that people are on their phones on the subway and everything, and it's true. But if you look at a picture of the subway in the 60s, everybody's in the newspaper.
Right.
That was a time for the granted, though. You can't vouch for what people are seeing on their screen, right? But you know that
cat videos,
at very common for people to, when they're commuting, to catch up on things. So what's changed is what they're consuming, and honestly, you said the integrity of the content that they're consuming.
The integrity is key, right? And also the diversity of content and the diversity of the integrity. I mean, I was just, not to get all, you know, Nick's obsessed, but I was reading about Nick's in the 90s and reading about this, the public relations guy. He would have to, seven newspapers. There were seven newspapers in the 90s, right? So he would have to collate, you know, the nights, you know, events, you know, and what, you know, what the team did, what other teams did. Imagine that there were seven newspapers. I mean, and they were people who had a beat and they knew what they were doing. And I think that's what I mean. Let us get into the death of newspapers, which is not just the terrible loss of journalism and journalists, but it's also they're you know, keeping watch over you know the nefarious doings, right? Keeping governments honest. I mean, and keeping communities informed. And when you have, I mean, influencer isn't doing that, and they're not embedded in a community, and they don't understand what's going on. They're not going down to the courthouse to report on. I mean, that you're losing so much we could take this out to, you know, what is happening, you know, what rules that are being rewritten, you know, as we speak, that are offending them. That was a curious slip of the lip. You know, that are changing the lives of people without their even understanding.
Well, that's the biggest, like, yeah, like when
it's not of journalism,
right? Because it's not, it's algorithms, right? They're just taking you a place that's not necessarily fruitful
or accurate. So in the
accuracy
algorithm is like, oh, okay. I mean, like, for example, I follow some corgis on Instagram because I have corgis, but now it's like I'm getting fed more corgis, but you know, it's like in a okay, well, where's the news? Where, you know, what about the laws that have just gone into place to you know, gerrymander certain political districts? You know, just like really consequential things, and people are just it's getting edited out because they're not paying
right because
to it. And then the algorithm is following that, so they're getting
it's
more
following
and more
that because them, they're sticking to it. So then the ads pop up, and it's not really designed to, you know, and.
And the incuriosity maybe is what really gets me.
The incuriosity. That's I think someone asked me, how do you know about all this stuff? I'm like, I'm just curious.
Right. And a desire to be informed.
Yeah. And you know, I don't like to, you know, I'd like to, yeah, to be informed and be able to speak intelligently, at least at a certain level. And I know when to stop. I know when I'm not speaking intelligently, and I will tell you that.
But it also just to be curious.
It's curious.
And to be receptive and to not to not accept simple answers to really anything. And I think that's I don't know. There's just, well, anyway, I could rant on, but I'll spare you.
Oh, you're here when I'm. Author, someone has something to say. What is this? Wine and Words, Notes for Better Drinking.
I just love that. That's the last wine book I wrote, which is umpteen years ago, but I think it's so beautifully done. It was embossed and debossed, which I learned what that was when it was published by Rizzoli, which everything they do is beautiful. And a good friend of mine was the designer, Allison Liu, and it has wonderful cartoons in it. And it's really just essays. It's like little snapshots and a fun sort of random take. And that was just for fun. You didn't have to hold it up.
There you go. Don't worry. I will put this section.
There are sales to be made.
I'll put this in the show notes. I will definitely put that in show notes.
It's good looking, right? Even if
it's a great looking book.
Don't open up the book
itself. It's beautiful. I like it. It's like old timey.
It's embossed. Yeah.
It's embossed
and debossed.
And the labels are different. And like the guy's like in a library, like kind of like a ladder going to get the bottles.
And that's the other thing that I love. Actually, some of the illustrator has done some illustrations for my column. Is that the journal gets so many great illustrators, you know, and that's, I feel like that is a field. Well, we've talked about magazines, but I mean, and writers, you know, like illustrators. There's so much talent out there, and writers and illustrators are making even less than they once did, right? I mean, so just that's the I look at.
Yeah, I mean,
so much talent.
It's true.
Another rant for another.
I know. When did you win your first James Beard Award?
2002.
So what'd you win? What was that for?
That was the MFK Fisher Award. That was for the sommeliers.
That piece
trailing the sommeliers. Yeah, at Veritas, and the. Second one was for the column series of Educating Peter, and which turned into a book. I almost brought that one too, but then I thought, oh my God, you know, MJ, I was like, you're bringing your whole library here. And Fear of Wine, the cartoon book. But it was Peter Travers, my friend then was a Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Yeah, so it was a three-part. So he was my neighbor in Mamaroneck when I lived in Mamaroneck, and we became friendly, and he was a very funny guy, as ignorant about wine as he's knowledgeable about movies. I mean, and Peter's very, well, if you're
yeah,
a fan, you know, follow him. So we had this idea, and everything that he talked about, he would say, I really like a fatty Chardonnay. Is that a fatty Chardonnay? And I was like, well, no. And then he would like seize on Riesling. It's like, is a Riesling a fat? And so I thought, you know, he was the perfect guy to use as sort of the straw man to ask all the dumb questions that a budding onophile would ask. And so it was a three-part series of educating Peter, won a James Beard Award, and then Scribner's, who published the book, said this would make a great book. So I did this. I mean, Peter and I sat down at a table probably every week. We'd taste and talk about wine. He's a very funny guy, so the book was lots of fun. And then as his graduation present, I took him to Napa. I paid for us to take a trip to Napa. And he got a little sidetracked because he became obsessed with the fact. And then I didn't even notice this until Peter pointed out, like, all winemakers wear vests. Like, he wanted a vest.
Oh, yeah. You know, like, oh, you know, that's – we talk about, well, like, starter kits for people, right? Like, so
so I had to buy
so for the PR for, like, wine people, you know, it's like, okay, let's get a middle-aged white guy, put him in a vest, right? Over a flannel, pair of boots, and a golden retriever.
Right.
In the vineyard, yeah. Like, you know,
maybe not a golden retriever, maybe a black lab or something, or an Australian shepherd, I think.
You know, I have a black lab mix, and you know, black dogs don't get adopted as much.
That's true. I read
so,
that.
So it would be a golden. It wouldn't be a black lab. It would be a golden.
Oh. Well, black labs are
the best. They're the best. They're the most loved.
Anyway, so that was Peter Travers, and that was the second.
That's so funny. So he had to get a vest. Did he get some Blundstones as well?
He was obsessed with it. No, not Napa. They don't, at least at the time when we went many
years. And I was going to say, and then so he brought up Napa. So, like, you probably couldn't take him on that trip to Napa per that article you wrote 2 years ago.
Well, fortunately, my trip with Peter was in 2007. So many, many years ago before the
So you wrote a column.
Why I can't afford to go to Napa anymore.
Right. And like,
can you afford to go to Napa anymore and pay $1,500 a night?
No, I'm going to stay in somebody's guest house, man.
Well, see, the Wall Street Journal, I don't take.
Yeah, I know you can't take. Exactly. Right.
And,
so,
and I don't have a budget for $1,500 a night.
Do so I? That's what I'm saying. I'm like, yeah, I'll take that guest house.
I went to the Anderson Valley instead, though.
I love Anderson Valley.
It's just magical. And it's like, you know, what Napa was in the 70s.
Well, that's everything. Yeah. They say that about Paso Robles. But it means is just an upcoming wine region, right?
But it can't be. You know the reason why? Do you know the reason why Anderson Valley will never be
so
Napa
fucking
Valley?
Far away and it's so hard to get to?
That's one. But also septic system.
Wow.
They
oh, yeah,
they,
yeah. They, that's right.
They don't have a septic system.
Yeah, that's right.
There's no – they have – yeah.
So,
they
yeah.
They can't expand.
They can't expand, right.
And they also have no hospital or medical. And so you have to basically be airlifted if anything goes wrong, which is very expensive. Those are the three things I learned, MJ, from winemakers. They're like, you know how many times I was airlifted off the mountain? I was like, wow, I didn't know that was a thing. I'm going to drive very carefully.
Yeah. I'm not. I don't drive when I go to wine country because, and even when you drive, I'm like, these fools drive fast on these roads.
Oh, yeah.
Used to it.
Scary stuff. Scary stuff, some of those.
But when you wrote that article, I'm sure there was like, it's like half. Half the people were like, this is great.
Well, it was true.
And
I mean,
half people were like,
it was all true. It wasn't opinion. It was very, if you read it, I mean, and that is the hallmark of anything that comes in the Wall Street Journal. It's all fact-checked and verifiable. And they did. They raised the rates extraordinary degrees post-pandemic. And I understand why. But
yeah, because they're trying to make up for lost profits.
I mean, I went from paying $250 for a room. It was three times that. And that isn't – I mean, that simply isn't true that it cost that much because, you know, the prices did not – triple. I mean, cost did not triple. And then wineries, of course, you know, and I understand it from their perspective, they went from, you know, tasting experiences as opposed to you just come up to a bar. But they also became extraordinarily expensive. And so a weekend in Napa, it'd be many thousands of dollars.
I mean, people like even things like Bottle Rock, right? The concert.
I've never been there.
Neither have I, but it's like, you look at it's expensive. First of all, just to get in, like they have packages.
How expensive is it?
I mean, I think I could look it up, but like, I want to say like an expensive ticket's like $900.
Uh-huh. To know? Just like stand around.
Yeah, probably. Like, I mean, and like, someone, and feel free to
Coachella kind of thing.
Message me on the pricing people. Okay. But but then they, but what I wouldn't talk about experience, but then they do have the ultra high level $10,000. Mm-hmm. You got the ultra deluxe tent with the heating and air conditioning and, you know, but that's just the festival. It's not even like
To stay there, to eat and drink.
Then they go eat and drink.
Right.
You know,
and to get a car.
I don't know anything. Like, you know, do you have surge pricing? Because if Uber has surge pricing, I'm sure, you know, a big event like that. But, you know, what would you say over the time you've been covering Food and Wine is.
Just wine, really.
Just wine.
A little bit of food.
Yeah. You worked at Food and Wine.
I did.
Wine. They cut, but I'm sure you, and maybe you didn't cut.
I ingest
it,
food.
But you ingest food, and you're evaluating alongside your wine.
Exactly. This is true. Not so much. Yeah. Not so much covering as consuming.
Yeah. What have been some of the, the more positive changes you've seen over this time? Because you did talk, you alluded to there. More women, there's more women winemakers.
Oh, you mean in the wine world?
Yeah, wine world
large.
Yeah, at large. At large, yeah.
Well, I think that it's the fact that it's a world to which so many different kinds of people aspire to belong is to me far and away the most positive change, because it's not just one sort of person, which when I was coming up was a white male, you know, and that there's so much more diversity, and that there's so much happening everywhere. That's the other biggest thing, that you can have an interesting wine from just about anywhere, and we talked a little bit about shipping and the complexities complexity is too kind of word to describe
the frustrations around.
But we have such unparalleled access to so much great wine, and there is so much talent, winemaking talent. I mean, yes, there are problems, and if I read one more piece about how millennials not drinking wine, which is a whole other story. But there's
I've talked about this. Most people don't, unless you have money or came drinking wine, you don't start drinking wine to make more money, which is usually after 30.
Right,
so why are people tripping
out? Now they're having trouble getting jobs.
Exactly. So it's not tracking.
Right. It's a wine problem.
Exactly.
It's a work problem.
Exactly.
It's a money problem.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is what I really hate, and I always like to look at the opposite of what other people are saying, and I'd be like, no, I don't think that's true at all. I don't think the wine world is suffering. I think, you know, young people are having trouble finding jobs, affording apartments, you know.
Yep.
And I wasn't drinking good wine when I was that age. Yeah. I couldn't afford it either.
Right.
So I'd be like, okay, get that off the table. But I think that the wider purview of the wine world, the greater access to the wine. I mean, greater access, but yes, greater difficulty, right? It's broader, but I don't know that maybe it's not deeper. But there are many ways to get into the world of wine that certainly didn't exist when I was
for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And
for sure.
Me
yeah.
too.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
Yeah. Mid late 90s for sure. It's completely different. I do this thing. It's a game.
Uh oh.
It's called slap.
I don't like game. Oh, slap.
Lick. Yep, slap. Uh-oh.
I don't
lick.
Have to do these things, do I?
No. Fondle. I'm going to give you three grapes. And this is just your.
Who's play this game with?
Everybody. It used to be FMK, just so you know. Yeah.
So, rushed up on this.
No, you know, it's okay. It's off. It's just for shits and giggles.
Can I choose different verbs?
No. It was FMK. So think about that. It was more. So I toned it down. But,
sexual harassment.
Yes, exactly. You know, it all kind of comes out of a.
Okay.
Eternity in 2000. Anyway, three grapes. Which one are you slapping? Which one would you like to lick? Which one would you fondle? Chardonnay, Pinot Noir.
Do I have to choose this?
Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay. Chardonnay.
Pinot Noir. And Cabernet Sauvignon.
Cabernet. I still need new verbs. The word fondle is just it's
two people someone's like
did they hated it too.
Well, it's actually where your mind goes, right?
It's not where your mind. I mean,
okay, so for you, okay, slap.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna argue.
Caress. caress.
I'd rather caress Chenin Blanc. Can I?
Nope. I get to pick it. Like, you try. Nope. You're going to get on back on track. Let me get you back on track here, LT.
Okay.
So slap the caress.
Okay. I'm going to slap Cabernet.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, tannin. And caress. Wait, what's caress?
You have Pinot Noir, Chardonnay.
Well, I mean, obviously Pinot Noir, you caress, right? I mean,
some people slap it because it's so finicky. Get out of my life.
Oh,
it's, that's why this game is very, it's an inside your mind. You're like,
come up with like a personality read after.
Probably.
Could you send it to me? Probably. I'll reveal it on camera.
I mean,
but I want Chenin Blanc to be one of the grapes.
Yeah.
I'm going to tickle that grape. Sorry, I'm going.
It's okay.
Rogue on you.
Exactly. So you're gonna caress Pinot, and then you're gonna lick Chardonnay, and I'll let you.
I'm not going to. You're putting those words in my mouth. I'm not owning that. Sorry.
I've put no words in your mouth. I've just given you parameters to a game.
I reject your grapes.
I know. She's just...
I want a new page.
She's just walking up the court with the basketball, not dribbling. Doesn't
like
work
the
like
Knicks
that.
The Knicks of the 90s. It's a flagrant wine game.
Actually, it's a flagrant wine game. So you were in Ireland.
Oh, we're back
on
to
a
the
semester.
Beginning.
Same court. Can you believe that?
You're circling around. Are we ending soon? Is that okay?
Yeah.
And you're beginning.
And you didn't even... And you're like, is this going to go that long? And now you're like, wow, I told you it would fly by.
Well, that's your take now.
Yeah, I am not inside your head. That's true.
Single sip of
I've had a sip of it. I tell you, it actually tastes a little better because it got some air, but yeah, it does taste a little bit better. But I mean, it's not, it's, I'm sure it's not the bottle
it's
you had
not,
last night.
It's not the bottle I had last night. I owe you.
Was there a bottle? Was there a bottle that like really started it all for you? Like, so you work in that shop, you're going to taste more wines, like, and it might not have been there, but like, was there a wine that you're like, oh, this wine is just, wine is something I like and want to know more about?
You know, there wasn't a particular wine. And, you know, the funny thing is, you've been a wine merchant. So Peter Dunn, the great Peter Dunn, would bring wine home every night when I was living with him as a student. And Ireland and Michelin Son is a big Bordeaux merchant, and so he would bring Bordeaux, and he never brought great Bordeaux. And I realized this when I went, well, I'll get to that. It's like he would bring like okay Bordeaux, and it was just because it was like a night at home. And his wife Anna's a terrific cook. That was the other revelation. Like, she made fish too, which I never had, you know, growing up. And so, but it was just like a wine to drink with food. And then fast forward, when I became the wine editor of Food & Wine magazine, and I went back and I wrote a column about my wine father. It's actually one of my most favorite columns. First of all, going back to Peter and saying, hey, look what happened. You know, I actually turned out to be, you know, the wine columnist at Food & Wine magazine, you know, in the way that, like, are you proud of me? Like, did you want to use my wine father? And I said, could you have predicted this? And he said, well, frankly, no. And I said, well, did any part of you think that? And he said, well, once you identified a wine that was it was corked, and I said, oh, okay. And he said, and then he had this dinner to celebrate my coming back. He served like really mediocre Bordeaux. Look at how it was Letty, but it was in a Magnum, and I was like, and I kind of love that about him. It was like, I don't know, like a Cote de Castillon or something. It was like really ordinary, from like a really ordinary vintage, and I just kind of love that because it wasn't about. So my point, and I'm circling back, was, but it was really just about. It was a wine that was like, it was about family and friends and people.
You were there with,
yeah, and I felt my mom actually, she'd never been to. She was Patricia Allen Sullivan from County Cork, but she'd never been to Ireland. And we had so much fun. People were singing and drinking and, like, you know, at the piano. And the wine was so incidental, you know. And here's a man who could have anything in the world, but he just... And so I wrote the column of the name of the or the title was Dublin Magnums, because they were endless. They seemed endless. There was like these endless magnums of really mediocre Bordeaux. But it was one of the most joyous nights of my life. So
that's awesome. So last question. This is general, or not just wine, but it could be wine, but it could be whatever, actually, because you have a new book coming out.
I do. Not wine.
Yeah. What are you most excited about in the future?
My book. Well, no, I'm excited, you know, two things. Well, yes, the book, but also like whatever it is I'm going to write about next. You know,
I love that.
Because, you know, you get an opportunity to, I guess, like, you know, like you'll forget me tomorrow and be excited.
Well,
about
no, it's
guest.
I mean, it's funny because we're like, what's your favorite interview? I'm like, right. No, the next one, because these are conversations.
Maybe not this one.
And I, you know, this is great. Let
definitely be the next one.
That's all the time. That's all the time we have for today. No, just kidding. I'm not. She's rushing herself out the door.
Gee, Willikers.
Oh, well, this was actually a lot of fun.
I like that you said actually.
You know, no, I mean,
and
no, I never know what to expect, but
this is true. Me too.
You know what I mean?
Me too. This is actually fun for me too.
Good.
That's what I like that we're actually surprised.
I know. No, I mean, I'm not, but you know, I am. Cause like what, like I would never want to be someone that'd be like, you like, oh, I crushed that article. Right.
Right.
Like,
right.
I'd be like, I mean, like,
no, you're just like, it's done.
Yeah. I'm like,
had some interviews where you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. I've had, I'll tell you about that when we're
off
done.
Camera.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
It'll be this one.
Yeah, not this one. Tell people where they can find you, how they can be a part of what you are doing.
Oh, the Wall Street Journal on wine, 3 out of every 4 Saturdays, in the off-duty section, the fabulous, fun off-duty section, which has fashion and travel and food and everything that you need to have a great life. So, yes.
Awesome. And for all you listeners out there, don't forget to check out the show notes for the episode. I'll list the book she brought. I'll list the wine we made. We didn't make.
No, you have to tell what I'm bringing instead next time.
Okay. All right. So maybe I won't list that. But I'll put links to, you know, to her in the Wall Street Journal. I'll put her Instagram if you want to. I don't know if she's open or private, but you know, just so you guys can keep up with Letty. She's got a great feed and she's got a lot to share. So until the next time, cheers to the Mavericks, philosophers, deep thinkers, and all you wine drinkers. Your boy MJ saying peace.
Peace.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned something and had some fun while you were here. Please subscribe to the podcast so that you are notified when a new episode drops. Also, we'd love it if you take a few seconds and give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening on. And don't forget to go over to beatsvinesandlife.com and get on the mailing list to stay in the know.